Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Well, the wonderful Malcolm Nance is here with us today. He's one of the world's leading experts in the strategy and tactics of the Al-Qaeda organization, international terrorism, global security policy, and torture. He has nearly three decades of field experience in anti-terrorism and counterterrorism intelligence and in combat operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. He's here to give us a perspective on what we're hearing in the news these days about ISIS and other terrorist organizations, how they're recruiting, why they're attracted to recruits, and how the rest of the world can fight them. So, there's a lot going on, and a lot of talk about all of it, and Malcolm Nance is here. So we want to know what you think. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And you know the rest of it. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. You can go to Facebook. You can go to the webpage. You have a lot of choices. But here we are. Malcolm, how are you?
I'm well. I'm glad to be here.
Great to see you.
Well, think of this as the anti-TED talk.
Do you see yourself as slumming when you come here? Because everybody wants a piece of you. Everybody wants to talk to you.
No, yeah. Of course not. I live here, so I love coming up to WAMC and talking to people who actually know me.
So what's going on? This is absolutely uber chaos, isn't it?
Yeah. Since we've last talked last November, and I do blame you for quite a bit of it, Alan.
Yeah.
There,
as well you should.
There really has been a... Not a spiraling out of control. What you're seeing is a propaganda effort on the part of ISIS and Al-Qaeda now. You see that which have cropped up in a couple of the new wars. But what you're seeing is an effort that has now put this organization in your face all the time. Even after 9/11, it was a situation where we would wait for Al-Qaeda to do something. Mm-hmm. But with ISIS, ISIS is now more of a concept, more of an idea that is now infiltrating the rest of the Middle East and taking away some of the power from its parent organization, which is Al-Qaeda. And you're hearing about it all the time because they control land in Iraq and Syria. Now, because you have the situation in southern Yemen spinning out of control, where Al-Qaeda may announce its own little caliphate down there. And you have ISIS popping up in Libya, Nigeria, Mali, just all over the place.
Let me ask a question that I think everybody's thinking.
Sure.
Why do they line up Christians and cut their heads off?
Okay. We discussed this before, but ISIS and Al-Qaeda come from a unified ideology which was synthesized by Osama bin Laden in the 1980s when he was fighting in Afghanistan. And instead of him fighting and, you know, thinking that they were kicking the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan, he went there to defend what he thought was a pure Muslims who were being put upon by one of the two major civilizations in the world, communism. So when they defeated the Soviet Union and they withdrew from Afghanistan, the Arab Mujahideen, the Arab fighters, all unified under Osama bin Laden after he killed off his rivals. And he believed that he had defeated Soviet communism because communism collapsed soon afterwards. And he believed that this was all part of that apocalyptic revelation.
Interesting. So he really thought so.
That he would have a clash of civilizations, and now he would incite the West to come to Afghanistan and do it again, and that's why you had 9/11.
So he wanted to bring the West
over. Absolutely, absolutely.
Because he thought he was indefeatable.
He believed in Samuel Huntington's clash of civilizations, and he now believes the last clash of civilization is his version of Islam versus everybody else, which, by the way, includes the 1.6 billion other, you know, Muslims who don't believe what he believes.
Interesting. Let's take one call very quickly. We'll go to Bruce in Kingston, 1-800-348-2551. You want to talk to Malcolm Nance? Now's the time to do it. You won't get near this at the end. All right, Bruce in Kingston, you're on.
Yeah, thanks. I have a question both for Alan and for Malcolm. And I've listened to Malcolm before, and I really respect what he has to say. You know, with all these, with the very sophisticated operations of recruitment, and we, you know, from all over the world, not just here, just to denounce these guys, and it doesn't matter where, because, you know, that my basic question is, all these denunciations seem weak. And And maybe what we need to do is to demonize them, because they're acting like demons. They're doing demonic things. They're going to they kill children. They kill students. Doesn't matter whether it's Kenya, whether it's in Northern Africa or the Middle East or in Pakistan. I mean, they're all doing the same kind of things.
Okay, here we go. Hold on a second, Bruce, because we're going to be up against a break in no time. Malcolm, you want to give an answer? Yeah. Stay there, Bruce.
Yeah, what's going on in Kingston? They ask some really smart questions every time I've been on here.
Kingston's good.
Call the new Nazis.
Well, actually, you know, my second book, An End to Al-Qaeda, was actually about a global campaign to not demonize them, but to actually call them out for what they are. The ideology of Osama bin Laden developed is actually the fifth manifestation of a religious cult in Islam. There have been four others. ISIS and Al-Qaeda have been equated to one group called the Kharijites, who existed in the 7th century. And they behave exactly the same, mass murder civilians. They want to re-engineer Islam in their own name. A guy by the name of Abu Yahya al-Libi in 2007 actually gave, he was a member of Al-Qaeda, gave us the tools to do it. He gave us his 6 points and how to damage the organization. And his first point was demonize us, turn us to actually refer to us as heretics, call out people who have left our organization to tell us how we've corrupted Islam, publicize our atrocities, put us up against democracy movements. And he put out these points almost mockingly because he knew about the Bush administration's incompetence in doing what we call counter-ideology warfare. And that's what needs to happen here. We need to go after their ideology, which is not Islam, by the way. It's so un-Islamic, it's almost anti-Islamic. And most Muslims in the world, if they knew the actual precepts of what they believe, which is like, you know, destroying the Kaaba in Mecca, eliminating and razing the tomb of the Prophet Muhammad, creating jihad and suicide martyrdom as two new pillars of Islam, most Muslims would, you know, be forced to believe that they're apostates, which requires severe punishment.
Yes. Yeah, so so let me see if my limited intellectual capacity gets us here. So what you're saying is that when they cut people's heads off, mm-hmm. And Bruce says, why don't we demonize them? It seems to me everybody's on the same side. They're demonizing themselves, and they want that.
Yes, and they are what they're doing is they're using what we call TSV, terror shock value. And they want you to fear them. They believe themselves that they are this instrument of the future apocalypse. You know, they believe the Muslim apocalypse in is almost the same as our Book of Revelations. The Mahdi will come. That's a savior and redeemer in Islam, the Imam Mahdi. He will fight the Antichrist and then will assist the prophet Jesus at the end of times. And then, you know, everyone goes on to heaven. So they believe in these apocalyptic statements. They are trying to invoke these actions with the West. So when they say they're going to kill Christians, it is against Islam to kill Christians and Muslims. Okay? Anybody that tells you any different doesn't know anything about the Quran. They are protected classes of people. ISIS is literally spitting in the face of Islam. They think the last 1,436 years of Islam is wrong.
Okay, so just to put a cap on this before we got a break,
yep.
What is the right move now? If they're spitting in the face of Islam, we have to say so.
We have to mobilize the Muslim world to reject them. The Muslim world understands, you know, 1.6 billion people, maybe they're just misguided young men who need to be brought back into the fold. But when they burned that Jordanian pilot, they almost lost off 1.6 billion people. And I think they're just one atrocity away of having the entire Muslim world turn on them.
Bruce, I'm so glad you called. Thank you very much.
Could they be called the new Nazis?
No, there's nothing like the Nazis.
Okay, so that's Bruce, and we'll be going to Bill as soon as we get back from a 7-second break. Go ahead.
Support comes from Fort Hill Auto Body, Amherst, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated since 1997, providing auto body repair, detailing, painting, and glass replacement. A proud supporter of public radio, FortHillAutoBody.com. Upstate Divorce Mediation, specializing in helping couples who are seeking a legal separation or divorce, offices in Albany, Saratoga, and Catskill. UpstateDivorceMediation.com. The United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, New York. Live United, Give, Advocate, Volunteer. UnitedWayGCR.org. Emmerich Sales and Service announcing their annual open house this Saturday at the 187 Valentine Road Charlton store from 8 to 3, featuring Cub Cadet Ride and Drive event. EmmerichSales.com. Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock and Rhinebeck, an organic, natural, local grocery since 1978 with handcrafted, locally made gifts, perfumes, lotions, and more for Mother's Day, Sunday, May 10th, on Facebook and sunflowernatural.com. And Fleury Lumber, Route 10, East Hampton, Massachusetts, providing information and advice for sprucing up current or adding new decks. From exotic hardwoods to composite decking, offering delivery, FleuryLumber.com.
And we're back. Thank you, Zachary. That's very kind of you to bring us back. So we're here with Malcolm Nance. As you know, he is one of the great experts on all of this. And he invites your questions, and we love having you with us. Let's go to Bill of Great Barrington. Bill, you're on.
Hello, Alan.
Hello.
Except for the religious aspect of it, what is the difference between what the CIA does and what ISIS is doing?
Well, the CIA is an intelligence collection agency,
and a torturing and a disappearing and a murdering agency, sir.
Well, not anymore. There was a short period there where.
Whoa, Bill. Listen, it's me, moderator. You called. You asked a question. As soon as the guest started to talk, you started to talk too. So let's let him talk first. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from, and. As a former intelligence officer, I am one of the great believers in ethics in intelligence, and I can tell you I've worked at several of the government agencies, including maybe affiliated with the one we're talking about. And what you will find is an enormous number of bureaucrats trying to do an incredibly difficult job. The things which went on in the period of the Iraq War. Which involved waterboarding, stress positions, which came from my community, the survival community. I know I've been waterboarded myself. These things were extra legal, and they should not have happened. ISIS is a terrorist organization which seeks the re-engineering of the Middle East and will kill everyone who is not of their organization. That is a distinct difference, so they are nothing alike.
That's all very well and good, but I don't believe that. Quite frankly, sir, I don't believe you. I believe the CIA is still doing the things that they've been doing all along. I believe they disappear and murder people all the time, and they work with governments around the world to do that to their own people as well. Okay. So good luck with the propaganda.
Okay. Bill, thank you for your call. Appreciate
your opinion.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
I'd like to make one little comment. You know, my family has fought in every war since the Civil War, African-Americans.
I remember that.
And I have fought to respect your right to have that opinion. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, it's sort of like religion in a way. Bill calls up. He said, okay, sir, I don't believe you. I don't believe you, and therefore, and that's a matter of faith. I mean,
well,
you
the
know,
Bourne Identity is not a documentary. It's a TV show.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Hey, you want to ask Malcolm Nance a question? Your chances of getting in at this moment are 100%. You dial that number, you're going to be on the phone with Malcolm Nance. 1-800-348-2551. And you will never have a better chance to talk to more of an expert on all of this. So, Malcolm, what's the Saudi role in all of this?
Well, that depends on what you think Saudi Arabia's interests are. Let's talk about what the Saudis believe. Right now, the Saudis have an obsession with Iran, which is, you can recognize it, you understand it. They don't want a country that has 90 million people, large oil wealth, very, very well-grounded middle class with great education system there, which does control a large swath of oil industry in this world. There are only 25 million Saudi Arabians. They control most of the oil production in the world. And these two nations are rivals. They don't want to see Iran with an atomic weapon, with a nuclear weapon. However, they also believe that Iran's meddling throughout the Middle East is now their top national security priority, which is why they are striking the Houthi rebels, who are Shia tribes in northern Yemen, with airstrikes, because they believe that Iran is supporting these rebels. They are at odds with Hezbollah and organizations like that who are Iranian-backed. However, they are doing it to the exclusion of ISIS and al-Qaeda, who are existential threats to the Saudis. They believe that Saudi Arabia, the royal class, and all the people in there who are not of their ilk should be killed. And they are showing in Iraq and Syria just precisely what they would do to the Saudis. However, the Saudis are almost completely, as we say in the military, target-focused on Iran and what Iran is doing.
Great. That's a good answer. I'm following along. Let's go to Rod in Voorheesville, okay? Rod in Voorheesville, you're on.
Hi. I have a question that I'd like to try on here. For quite a long time now, there's been an awful lot of chatter about Iran and the danger that it presents if it has a bomb. I have, that is, a nuclear weapon. I don't know how many Americans know this. It's not certainly not publicized, but the Iranians have said for a long time, over 5 years, that they don't want nuclear weapons. And the reason that they don't want them, and they're not trying to get them, the reason that they don't want them is that they are a useless liability. They have no use and, in fact, are a burden. I have yet to hear anyone respond to that. Everybody wants to talk about whether they really want one or not, but until you answer their allegation that the reason that they don't want them is that they're useless, until you deal with that, it seems to me you don't need to go into the question of their intentions.
Okay, Rod,
so I'd like somebody to give me... I'm going to do a television reality thing. I want to know a scenario for Iran with the bomb. You're the Ayatollah. You have the bomb tomorrow. What are you going to do?
Okay, Rod. That's your question. Yeah. Let's get an answer. Go ahead.
Okay. That is a very good question. To tell you the truth, most Iranians, certainly right now, are feeling the pressure from the international sanctions regime. They want Red Bull. They want Nutella. They want to go shopping in Dubai and, go to the malls. They want what we have in the West. They are a relatively sophisticated society. They are very well educated. They know more about the United States than we know about them, believe me. If you want to know about Iran, just watch the Daily Show's TV program that when they went to Iran and they started talking to the average Iranian. But what they also understand is that having an atomic weapon, having a nuclear weapon, is fraught with a series of difficulties that could lead them to economic collapse. No one will buy their oil. They will not be able to import or export anything of any significance. It is more of a distraction, and that is why the Iranians have come to the table. The nuclear deal that was set up by President Obama that's being negotiated with the Iranians by Secretary Kerry is a very, very good deal. They will not get a nuclear weapon with what if they come to the terms of that agreement, they will not get a nuclear weapon. That system will be dismantled.
And but they don't want a nuclear weapon.
That's correct.
We've been doing all this negotiation to try to persuade that the Iranians that they shouldn't have a nuclear weapon, which they've agreed to 5 years ago,
right,
that they neither want or
now we need
to
take get. Now we need to take the tools out of that toolbox. We need to take apart the centrifuges. We need to put the IAEA in there to inspect. And because that's the only way that we'll be able to guarantee this. We can take them at their word, but as you know, they said before,
there's no question
trust
about
but verify.
Taking them. No. What? Give me the scenario.
Hey, Rod. This is me, moderator. I want to point out, I know you're passionate about this, but when you talk, he stops. When he talks, you stop. Okay?
Got it.
Go ahead, Rod.
It's
a,
I still think that unless you can describe how a venture, how a danger eventuates itself, that is, how that danger manifests itself, then there's no danger.
Okay.
Now, you nobody has been able to say how that danger would come. What would happen if the Ayatollah had a bomb tomorrow?
I'll answer that question in one short answer. The real danger here, regionally and globally, if Iran were to suddenly pop up with a verifiable nuclear weapon, is the potential for regional atomic war. I find it very hard to believe that Israel will not see that its existence is at risk and that they would not feel that they would have to preemptively remove that atomic risk by using a nuclear weapon themselves.
And what would they do the next day?
That's a very good question.
Well, I mean, it's nonsense, isn't it?
We need to make sure we don't even near there.
Whoa, Rod. Okay. Rod, we hear your very excellent question. We thank you for making the call. Thank you.
That's a good question.
Now we'll go to Bill in Herkimer, where they make diamonds. Bill, you're on. Hey,
yes,
Bill.
Yes, hi. I had a couple questions. My first question is, you know how they have the surgical strikes, in ISIS, on ISIS, I mean, the targets, where we're trying to eliminate collateral damage. Well, I just don't understand one thing. If we're surgically striking ISIS in certain areas, and I was living next door to these fellas that were, shooting missiles over at everybody, I would move out. I mean, it would be a smart move for me to move out and get out of there. When did we become we're fighting a war. There's going to be casualties, okay? If we're striking these guys, we got to tiptoe around and figure out who's living next door and to make sure we hit this exactly correctly right. I mean, if somebody's living next door or around the area or in the 100 feet of there, they should get out. I mean, that would be the sensible thing to do, and that would, that would eliminate.
Okay, Bill from Herkimer. I think you make an interesting point. Now we've got to Malcolm.
It's a good point. And unfortunately, the areas that ISIS occupy right now, the populations there are captive populations. They are moving into schools. They're moved into mosques. They understand the capacity for us to strike. They understand that they're being surveilled. But when we use the phrase targeted strike, when you're talking about a military capacity, that just means that we have the ability to put a 2,000-pound bomb into a 1-foot by 1-foot square. That doesn't mean that the 2,000-pound laser-guided JDAM bomb is not going to obliterate everything within 1,000 yards. It will. If we use a drone and we use a Hellfire missile, then we can put a missile through a window and we can kill everybody inside the building. But war is very, very messy. We are killing people. There is collateral damage. Civilians are dying. However, we are fighting a force which essentially has taken about 6 million people as human shields. They're all living right next door to these people. So
let me...
We go by rules, and they don't. What I'm simply stating is that you can't fight an enemy by our rules and expect to win. You have to go in there and get them.
Okay. Stop. Put a period there, Bill. Go ahead, Malcolm.
Yeah, well, you can. We've fought wars, and wars are messy affairs. And, if you put a squad of Marines or a platoon of Marines down there, you're going to get far more civilian casualties just with the flying bullets and the artillery and the mortars than you would with a JDAM or, a Hellfire-guided strike. But as far as rules go, this is what we are. We play by the rules, and this is why torture was so abhorrent. It violated our sense of ethics, but we cannot go and play by their rules. We are not ISIS. We are the United States of America, and like I said, my family has 110 years of playing by the rules, and it is something that I think we're fully capable of doing.
Bill, five people behind you. No. You're done.
Thanks, Bill.
Okay, and let's go to Steve in Ludlow. Okay, Stephen Ludlow, you're on.
Yeah, hi, thanks.
Sure.
Let me just qualify I'm going to ask you a question about what you think about something that happened in history, but I want to qualify that by saying and I don't mean this as an insult. It's just the way that I'm kind of hearing what's being said by your guest. You seem like maybe a little bit of an apologist for the CIA and kind of the establishment. And again, I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't know your heart. You may be very, very much in love with your country, and I applaud that. But let me just get that out of the way. My question is, would be your take on America's overthrow, and I don't know if I'm getting the names right, whether it was Mossadegh or the Shah in Iran, and how that may have laid the groundwork for our relationship with Iran these days, and in fact, the larger Middle East.
That's a good point. First, I'm not an apologist. I love my country a lot. And you know, my views are based on what we call ground intelligence. I only speak based on what is real hardcore intelligence fact. That's what professionals do. And I don't apologize for the errors that we've made, and I accept them. And one of those errors was the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in 1952 and setting up the Shah of Iran, which created an oligarchy which was violently overthrown by the Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979. And a lot of that is just water under the bridge now. Iranians themselves, 90 million of them, are not all violent jihadists or revolutionary Khomeiniites. There is a very small minority of them, and we have negotiated with Russia, with China, all of whom are now international trading partners, Vietnam, a country that killed 59,000 of our soldiers. Nations change, and we should allow ourselves to allow this process to play out and perhaps effect some change.
Do you think? Do you see a pattern? However, let's take Mubarak in Egypt.
Well, we didn't overthrow Mubarak. That was done.
No.
Egypt dabbled in democracy, and now the you know, the Egyptian regime, the military themselves, decided to put an end to that experiment. We didn't have anything to do with that, and you can't blame the president for not doing that. You know, getting involved in that, because
yet
it would have been seen as a Mossadegh type situation.
Yet, Malcolm, I think they're the number one and number two foreign aid recipients in the world.
Yeah, we definitely supported the regime.
Yeah, so somehow we had the choice of saying no more until we get some democracy over there.
Right.
But we didn't do that, and I certainly understand it.
Yeah, that was an internal war. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, could I ask one more pointed question?
As long as it's short.
Does the CIA run drugs?
No.
Is that why we're in Afghanistan?
No.
Four times since the U.S. occupation.
No, as a matter of fact, the DEA has been burning poppy fields in Afghanistan for the last 10 years. It's not doing very well because there's no alternative crop for those people to make money. And one of the great failures of the invasion of Afghanistan.
Steve, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Let's go to Caroline in Woodstock. Okay, Caroline, we only got about 3 minutes before we have a break, but go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I actually have a question about the Muslim community. I want to know, you know, why is there not more of a kind of like, you know, resistance and outcry about this? You know, I want to know from, you know, like your take on people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who I actually really admire, who I feel like there's a lot of like upset about her. And I also would like you to talk about the power of belief, because I can't help but kind of make a connection between, there was a show on previously on NPR about, you know, the hierarchy in survival and what happens to guys in combat, and about the, you know, the euphoria that happens when people in a group believe the same thing.
Okay, Carolyn,
the power of that.
Carolyn, let me just say, we only have 2 minutes to answer here.
Okay, I'm fine. I'm going to hang up.
No, don't hang up. Stay right there.
I'm going to listen.
Let me answer the question about Ayaan Hirsi Ali. She espouses an opinion where she came from Somalia, she moved to the Netherlands, and she rejected the faith that she grew up in. And she has all that. She has the right to do that. In her most recent book, she believes that Islam itself has to fundamentally change. And in fact, she wants Islam to change into a religion which she believes is more peaceful, to be closer to Christianity. You can't ask 1.6 billion people to give up what they believe, no matter how well intended.
I don't think she's doing that. You know,
Carolyn,
I've read her book and I've seen her interviews, and she says just that. She says inflammatory things because that's what she believes in her heart, and I can't fault her for that. And hopefully she has enough protection around her, but for the most part, she believes that Islam itself has a problem.
Okay, listen.
Okay, so can you address the Muslim?
No, you cannot, because we have to take a break. That's the rules. I appreciate your calling.
Thank you.
It's
good
of you to call. Thanks a lot. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Take it, Zach.
Support comes from Hudson Valley Goldsmith, New Paltz. For Mother's Day weekend, handmade artisan jewelry, conflict-free diamonds, recycled gold wedding bands, and estate jewelry. HudsonValleyGoldsmith.com. Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenAndPerrin.com. Kingsway Community, Schenectady, New York, offering a continuum of care and services to area seniors since 1975, including memory care and more, caring in the family tradition. 518-393-8800. Fulton County Tourism, in the Southern Adirondack Park, camping, hiking, biking, boating, fishing, on our 44 lakes, events and performances. 44 lakes, 44 choices, 44lakes.com. And Habitat Post and Beam, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, designing and manufacturing energy-efficient post and beam homes and additions throughout the Northeast since 1972. PostandBeam.com.
So let me tell you what's happening, everybody out there. Denise and Jeff and Ken and Brian, somebody else, all on the phone. All five phones are ringing, so we're going to... This is the last third of the program, so you got to really move here. Now, I know everybody feels passionately about their positions. Nevertheless, short question, short answer, and we'll move on and try to get everybody in, okay? Let's go to Denise in Saugerties. Denise, go.
Hi, Alan and Malcolm. Thank you for taking my call, and Malcolm, thank you for your service. My family has also fought in the war, and they're African-American from Philly. Okay. Anyway, I would like.
Denise, for some reason.
Could you talk about the Baathists and their current alliance with ISIS?
The Baathists. Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, if you go to the blog called Phase Zero on Gawker today, I have an entire interview that was done of about 3,000 words where I discussed the Iraqi Baathists, the Saddam loyalist, who are deeply, deeply a major component of ISIS and the ISIS leadership. Der Spiegel wrote an article 2 days ago where they talked about the key military commander of ISIS, Haji Bakr, and how he was an ex-Air Force colonel, Air Defense colonel. In fact, he was an Air Force internal security intelligence officer whose job it was to put down internal dissent and find traitors within the organization. So he developed the entire military strategy for ISIS with the cooperation of the exact same people we fought from 2003 to 2009, the Iraq insurgents, 88,000 ex-Saddam loyalists, many of whom now are deeply embroiled with ISIS. ISIS, on the other hand, though, has that al-Qaeda cult ideology templated over this organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Denise, thank you for the call.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay, got two very fast ones from the internet. One question: can't get through the really important. Is there a real threat of training camps on U.S. soil? Example: Hancock, New York, or Deposit, New York?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, I know the guy who came up with that, this young guy who's on Fox News now, national security analyst, who says that there are these Islamic training camps in the United States. Well, you don't have to have an Islamic training camp. I'll tell you a quick story that will shock all of you. In 2001, In the year 2000, I was teaching at the U.S. Navy Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape School. I was teaching their terrorism training program, survival program. And I was at a shooting range, and I heard four lanes down from me two young Saudis shooting a .22 caliber pistol. And one guy was just shooting it hesitatingly, bang, bang. And the other guy was shooting it like a professional, like a machine gun. And I thought, oh, great, Saudi Navy guys who were here. They were speaking Saudi dialect Arabic, didn't think anything about it. 1 year later, after 9/11, I went back to San Diego to train ships that were going out to sea and to Afghanistan. And then it struck me that I recognized one of those young men. He was one of the 19 hijackers from 9/11. Whoa. And he was carrying out internal terrorist cell training in a shooting range in San Diego. It was duly reported to the FBI. And that's how you do training. You don't have to have your own camp. You don't have to do Boy Scout Jamboree type training. You can go to any of the thousands of training facilities here in the United States, or just get a blank field and buy your rifles and weapons legally, and you can carry out all the training that you want.
Okay. And here's another one. As I understand it, the Arabic name for them is Rudder. Why don't we call them by what their neighbors do? Isis was a legit Egyptian goddess, and she wants her name back. Let that speak for itself.
Okay. Let it speak for itself.
Okay, let's go to Jeff in Gardner. Jeff in Gardner, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Yesterday evening, I was speaking with a very dear friend, and we're both about 65 years old, and he asked me in an anguished voice, how could young Americans be going to join ISIS? So my question is,
how could young Americans be going to join
ISIS? Is there anything you could say to help a couple of old baby boomers have any concept of what young people would be thinking to go join and fight for ISIS?
Yes, I can give you the exact answer. Charles Manson and the Manson family. These people, there is no difference between the women that join the Manson family, like Squeaky Fromm, and who go into a group which is popular, charismatic, may have a leader, which gives them something which they don't have in their lives at that point. ISIS and Al-Qaeda are a religious cultist ideology. Steve Hassan, the famous cult expert out of Massachusetts, calls them a destructive religious cult as opposed to a positive religious cult.
I think that's a good answer, Jeff. We're going to have to leave it with that. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Let's go to Ken in Ticonderoga. Ken, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for your service, Vietnam vet. And my question is, your opinion of Netanyahu's saber-rattling and attempts to scuttle the agreement before the agreement, after the agreement, while he's sitting on a huge nuclear arsenal, railing about somebody else maybe getting a nuclear weapon.
Yeah. You know, lived in Israel, spent a lot of time there, worked with them. Great country, fun, super, super liberal. It's really, I don't quite understand why Netanyahu feels that he should counteract the opinion of every Mossad head in the last generation that has said that it is not in the interest of Israel to scuttle this deal. We don't want Iran with an atomic bomb. Nobody wants that. No one wants to put Israel in a situation where they may have to launch one to get rid of one. And that's what it could come down to. Israel does not have the capacity. The United States doesn't really have the full capacity to destroy that nuclear weapons program if they decide to go further underground and to expand it. When Israel attacked Osirik nuclear power plant in Iraq in 1981, the Iraqis quintupled the amount of money that they put into that program, and they went on a crash program to get the atomic bomb. We don't need that. Israel is playing internal politics right now with Iran's nuclear program, and they've sort of passed that message on to the United States Congress, and I don't think it's healthy for America or Israel.
Ken, thank you. We're going to leave you with that. Appreciate it. Let's go to Brian in Northampton. Brian in Northampton, you're on.
Hi, so glad to talk with you. I just wanted to talk a little bit about Kurdistan and Rojava and how I just think it's incredible what they're doing over there. They're building really an egalitarian, worker-based kind of young nation, and really pretty effectively fighting ISIS. They're pretty instrumental in Kobani. And, yeah, I would just like you to tell us a little bit more about them, if you could.
Okay. Yeah, spent a lot of time in Kurdistan. Been up Erbil, Sulaymaniyah. I like Kurdistan. That's the little mini Switzerland part of Iraq that you can go to where you can, you know, not have to worry about suicide car bombs every day. However, what's going on in Kurdistan proper, which is a autonomous governorate of Iraq, is different from what's going on in Syria, Kurdistan, in northern, you know, in eastern Syria where Kobani was. Those are a completely different group of Kurds. And believe me, the people that have the most interest in this game are the Turks. The Turks do not want to see an independent Kurdistan. Almost 30% of Turkey, I think that's the number, is occupied by people who are of Kurdish descent. A good part of Iran, I think about 10% of Iran in the northwest, are also Kurd. And what they don't really want is to see a very powerful Kurdistan. But saying that, the Turks have invested a lot in Iraq's Kurdistan for its stability, its contracts, its oil. And what they want to see is a slow glide of this part of Iraq to maintaining the union. But what's going on with ISIS and the Kurds in eastern Syria is just, you know, ISIS says it themselves. It's genocide. They intend to kill every one of them that they can get their hands on and sell their women and children into slavery because they believe that this is part of their apocalyptic destiny. So for the most part, the Kurds are the leading edge right now. They took some shots last June and July that showed that they were out of training to a certain extent, but with American air power, they're doing very well.
Cool. Well, do you think there's any way we could sort of intercept people who might otherwise end up in the hands of ISIS fighting for them and sort of show them that, like, they can work together with their community and build a better Middle East, essentially?
You mean Americans who are going to work with the Kurds?
No, I'm saying, like, is there any way we could launch some sort of an education campaign towards people who are susceptible to recruitment by ISIS and show them a better way?
Okay, we're going to have to take an answer here, Brian, and that's going to be it. Go ahead.
It's a good question.
Thanks. Thank you. I'm going to actually hang up because my battery is dying, but
sure,
thank you.
Thanks.
We're trying that now. The problem is, again, it's been 15 years in the making. We have not created an integrated counter-ideology war against the ideology of the global Islamic Jihad, which I call the cult of Jihad. It's not even Islamic. Most Muslims reject it, once you know. The problem is that we're trying to do it piecemeal. If the State Department says it has no validity, this has to come from the Muslim world. And the Muslim world has rejected it. But Fox News and MSNBC and CNN, they won't play those rejections. They're not sexy. The Grand Mufti of Egypt called ISIS, said they couldn't even be called Islamic. You have to call them the Al-Qaeda separatist of Iraq and Syria. The Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia said ISIS is the number one enemy of Islam. Those are the top two Muslims in the world, but they do not get the microphone that Fox News gives ISIS when they behead someone.
Okay, Malcolm, that was wonderful. We'll go to Julius in Hillsdale. Okay, let's go. We have a few minutes left, and we could probably sneak one or two more in if you want to call 1-800-348-2551. Julius in Hillsdale. You're on. Welcome back.
Hi. You've actually answered my questions. Two earlier callers talked about recruitment and possible strategies against recruitment, and Malcolm is speaking to that. So that was the substance of my question. I really don't have any more to add.
Okay, Julius, thank you. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Right.
Okay.
Bye.
And let's go to Isaiah? Isla in Glenmont.
Yes.
Okay, go.
Hi. How are you? I have a question regarding the actual meaning of terrorism,
mm-hmm.
and I'm specifically asking because I listened to the news, the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing,
mm-hmm.
and I did not hear the word terrorism used once.
Hmm.
And also when Israel bombed the Muslims during the month of Ramadan for almost 20 days, if not more, I didn't hear the word terrorism used there either. So I am going to hang up, and I would like to know, what does terrorism mean in your opinion? Thank you very much.
Okay, that's good points. Terrorism has, there's technical definitions of terrorism, and then there's interpretive definitions of terrorism. The technical definition of terrorism is political violence which is enacted in order to achieve a goal or extract a concession in which the victims are not the immediate audience of the act of terror, which means it's political violence. The Oklahoma City bombing was without a doubt, no question, an act of terrorism. It was an act of terrorism carried out by an American citizen. These things happen. Timothy McVeigh was a terrorist. And believe me, I watched every minute of the Oklahoma City bomb trial. I've been out to the Oklahoma City bombing site. I've studied at their center. That was an act of terrorism. What Israel carried out in Gaza technically is not terrorism. What that is an act of war. Now, if terrorism occurs within a war, it can rise to the technical definition of a war crime. And so as you see it now, people will say, oh, people are terrified. People do this, people do that. When the Israelis bomb a rocket site in Gaza, they're going after the rocket site. But like I said earlier, when you shoot bullets by the thousands, or you start, you know, trying to get an individual inside a building and you knock down the building, that could rise to a war crime. But if you do it within the context of a military operation, it can meet the legal definition of war. And a lot of people have grief with that, but you have to go after people who conduct war crimes, same as we do with our service members.
And we go now to Tom in Bolton Landing. Okay, Tom, you got to make it fast because we're almost out of time.
Okay. I'm just finding it kind of ironic and hypocritical that we, the only country that has ever used a nuclear weapon against another population, are the ones who should be the policemen of the world for this issue.
Okay, that's a question.
I'll hang up and...
Okay, thank you.
Comment. Yeah.
Malcolm, keep it short if you can, because we're running out of time.
Well, you know, we did use the atomic bomb twice. That's enough, okay? I spent a lot of time when I was in high school being wooed by the nuclear industry at the World Affairs Council of Philadelphia, and I was taking the nuclear power plants. I've served on atomic submarines. I've run right next to the reactor for an hour. I know the power of an atomic weapon. I've seen computerized simulations at national command centers play out. We do not want this scourge on this planet. Whatever we can do to control it, awesome.
Okay. Very, very, very quickly, Martha, you're on, but only for seconds. Go ahead.
I have one question without a comment. Mm-hmm. I want to know, are there words in the Quran or any other sacred Islamic literature that require believers to kill the infidels, quote?
Yeah, and in the Old Testament, but only within the concept of what was written at that time when the Prophet Muhammad was fighting a small battle between the people he was in Mecca and Medina, and the battles between those people. That phrase is taken out of context. The Quran, which I've read many times and I use every day in my counter-ideology operations, the Quran itself has dozens and dozens of restrictions and exhortations towards respect, compromise, and no war. It even warns against people who fall in with the lust of war. So, you know, I could go back to the Old Testament and talk to you about how we're supposed to knock down a city in siege and kill every man, woman, and child inside it. That is not the operating system that people...
Okay. Martha, Malcolm, thank you very
much.
Thank you. We are out of time.
Yikes.
I want to thank everybody who called in, and your questions were great today. And apologize to Rob and Kirk and Suzanne, who all called today. So sorry. Malcolm, thank you, as always, for being so good with us and giving us all this time. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Redbud Development, collaborating with residential clients to design and build functional outdoor spaces that reflect their lifestyle. RedbudDevelopment.com, Temple Sinai, Saratoga Springs, New York, presenting Saratoga Community Arts Series, second annual Jewish Day Jewish storytelling event and dinner Sunday at 5 p.m. 518-584-8730 for reservations. And Empire Exhibits and Displays, Mechanicville, New York. Custom exhibits, interactive displays, and commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors, empireexhibits.com. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond, skidmore.edu/Tang. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WMC.org/Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Michelle Keckey. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.